Members, the hour of 3 o'clock having arrived, we will call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. We've got six or seven bills on the agenda today, and I think that we do now officially have a quorum. I think we're going to
Representative Haley first.
Yeah. Representative Haley, you are first. House File 3198. And while you're up there getting ready, Representative Nash, have you had a chance to review the minutes from our last meeting?
Mr. Chair, I did, and I move the minutes.
Representative Nash moves the minutes. Are there any comments, questions, or concerns about these minutes? Seeing none, those in favor of the adoption of these minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
So, thank you, Representative Davids, for approving the minutes. Those opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. Motion prevails. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Davids. I will move House File 3198 so that it is in front of the committee. Representative Haley, welcome to the committee, and please proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Since this is the first time I've presented to Commerce, I do have some snacks today, and I'm all about health.
Representative Haley, it's an afternoon committee. We were thinking cheeseburgers.
Well, I'm all about lowering health insurance costs, so you have homemade granola, or if you don't like that, Girl Scout cookies.
Well, we'll accept that.
Thank
Very
you.
Nice. Please proceed with your bill.
I do have some testifiers, but I assume you want me to start with the bill, and I can call them forward.
Yeah.
Okay. And you should have an author's amendment, Mr. Chair. Do you want to move that first?
We do. I will move the A1 amendment. I assume that's just technical to get the bill in the shape you'd like it to be. Those in favor of the adoption of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Go ahead to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you know, my district, which is Goodyear and Wabasha counties, so southern Minnesota along the Mississippi River, has some of the highest individual health insurance rates in the state. And the disparity between Goodyear and Wabasha counties and the next neighboring county, for example, Dakota County, can often be in the range of 40 to 60%. This is the number one concern in my district, not just the impact of paying high health insurance rates, but it's having a substantial economic impact on our ability to grow and sustain as small communities, and my testifiers will give you some examples of that later. But first, let me tell you about the bill and just outline the problem and how I hope to address it. The bill requests for the Office of the Legislative Auditor to study the cost disparities in Minnesota's rating areas in both the individual and small group markets and to make recommendations to us in the legislature on how we can reduce or eliminate those disparities. I'm well aware that simply asking for a study doesn't solve a problem, but I believe we need to have good data in order to prepare for future decisions that this legislature will need to make on all areas of health insurance. So I want to bring awareness to this broader economic impact, as I stated. It's not only southeastern Minnesota, but really all of rural Minnesota that is facing these issues. And I'm looking for a nonpartisan body, such as the Office of the Legislative Auditor, to be able to document this with actuarial data and to give us recommendations as a starting point for us to consider. The problem is complex, as we all know, but I don't think that should stop us from moving forward. Let me tell you the four things that the bill asks of the legislative auditor. First, to identify the factors that are causing the higher insurance rates in certain geographic areas. Second, to identify the impact of referral centers, the impact that they have on rates in southeastern Minnesota, and ways to reduce that disparity between the metro. Third, to determine the extent of the effect on individuals and small employers in these high-cost geographic areas to obtain health insurance versus lower-cost geographic areas. And fourth, to develop at least three proposals for redrawing the geographic rating areas and calculating the effect on each. I'd like to make a comment as well on the process of developing this bill. My request for this data isn't meant to poke any individual entity in the eye. I've worked closely with Mayo, with the Office of the Legislative Auditor, with a number of health insurance providers, and with MDH and the economists that study health insurance pricing in the state. I seek to partner with all of these different stakeholders to understand the dynamics that we are facing as a state. And as I said, this doesn't affect not only my district, but all of rural Minnesota. I'd like to point out that we have outstanding health care, and we also have outstanding health insurance institutions. But I believe our model of pricing and spreading risk is broken, and that's what I seek to address. Lastly, related to data gathering, I don't specify a specific prescribed method in the bill or source. I'm relying on the conversations between Commerce, the OLA, MDH, and the providers. There are various sources of data that we can use. And the purpose of gathering the data is not to be punitive, but again, to reach a common understanding based on actuarial facts so that we can analyze and propose solutions. I heard a phrase this morning in committee from a school data expert I'd like to share, and it resonates with what I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to have the data be used as a hammer. I'm trying to gather the data instead to be used as a flashlight so that we can illuminate the problem and illuminate some new models going forward. With that, I am open to questions right now, Chair, or I could have my testifiers come up if you'd like to wait and have questions after.
Representative Hillstrom has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Haley. You said that you were looking for a nonpartisan person to give you information. Why did you only have partisan authors if you are looking for a nonpartisan proposal?
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hillstrom. I'm not sure I understand your question about nonpartisan authors.
I think Representative Hillstrom is offering to be a co-author on the bill.
Did I
misunderstand that, Representative Hillstrom?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's just, usually when we have someone coming and saying that they're looking for a nonpartisan or bipartisan solution to something, usually then the authorship reflects such, and I was just curious as to why the authorship didn't necessarily reflect the statements in committee, Mr. Chair.
My assumption is she was looking for somebody from its next committee stop in HHS reform. They're known for signing on to just about anything.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom, and point well taken. That is probably an oversight on my part simply because of our quick committee deadlines and wanting to get this moving, knowing it has to move through multiple committees.
Representative Haley, we like to hear you say that. I think Representative Hillstrom is making a nice point. It's always nice to have bipartisanship authors when you're looking for something like this. So thank you for saying that. And with that, let's go to your testifiers.
Okay. I have three testifiers. I'll introduce them while they're making their way up, and one is still on his way here, I believe. Bob and Marlene Banks are owners of Strike Tool and Banks Outdoors in Cannon Falls, Minnesota, and Bob also serves on the EDA board. We can pull up one more chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourselves for the tape, and whenever you're ready, proceed with your testimony.
I'm Robert Banks. And this is my wife, Marlene Banks.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. Well, as you as she announced, I'm kind of wearing two hats here. I sit on the EDA board. But as a small business owner, I've had my business in Cannon Falls since 1984, family business. I was very passionate about this a few years ago as health care costs just started skyrocketing. And I kind of forgot about it here in the last couple of years. And I was shocked as I had my insurance provider compare Area 1 to Area 8. And, of course, southeastern Minnesota is Area 1. Area 8 is Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the Metro. To understand kind of our issue and why we notice it so much, as an EDA, Dakota County borders our industrial park to the west. So after comparing this, I was literally shocked at what it was to go from, if you had a business in Area 8 in Dakota County, 1 foot across the boundary in Dakota County, you would pay 65% more right now for my employees for health care moving to Area 1. And that's the numbers. Anyway, so not only is my business is strapped this way, I got to put on my EDA hat, and we have this discussion, EDA all the time. How do you attract people to Cannon Falls or southeastern Minnesota? And it used to be, you know, we'd TIF and tax increment financing and you do your deals, but now it's healthcare costs are more than the taxes. So to attract something from Dakota County to Goodyear County do we tell people when they come? Do we kind of keep it quiet until they come to Cannon Falls and they realize this? But as far as big business goes, their corporate office might be in St. Paul, but they're doing their manufacturing in Cannon Falls. That can work. So the same employees, are covered under St. Paul's rates. We all love Mayo Clinic, but we have no choice when they bought our hospital and this and that. It was great health care. We're not arguing that, but the rates difference is just out of line. They started a development about a mile out of the city limits in Cannon Falls, and it kind of wraps around the west side of our golf course. We had people, young people, moving out of Cannon Falls. Their health care savings is almost making their new house payment. That's how out of whack this is. As far as numbers go, this is as of yesterday. If you're in area area 8, for my same employees, and I have about 35 employees, and I employ about 10 extra employees during the summer, but obviously some of our employees are coming from the north, and they're not taking our health care because it's cheaper to have them have their own. So as you can imagine how we're trying to compete for business here, well, the struggle is. But if I was in Dakota County, right across 1 foot out of our industrial park, I would be paying a monthly premium for all our employees is $14,757.
Depending on the plan, of course, Mr. Chair.
Depending upon the plan. But this is our plan, okay? And in our Area 1, we're paying $22,662 a month for my employees. So you can understand the dilemma here. We're right. Just being killed in southeastern Minnesota.
No, we understand. This committee has dealt a lot with health care and health insurance and the relationship between the two over the last few years.
Mr. Chair, my other testifier is here. If we can allow a couple minutes.
Sure. We have a couple minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, hang on 1 second, sir. Representative Davids, did you have a question for the testifier or for the author?
Well, yes. First of all, when Representative Hillstrom was talking about being bipartisan, this is an issue that has been very bipartisan but more geographical than partisan, because I would suggest, Representative Haley, that you talk to Representative Liebling because she has studied this extensively. And her and I were working together and we were on some amendments together. And I haven't read the bill because I don't read bills. But would your bill, and maybe I'll ask Larry about this, would this bill lower 1 and then increase 8?
Ms. Bunko.
Chair and Representative Davids, the bill is for a study by the OLA. What determination they would make of how to set up the geographic lines is really dependent on the data they receive.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let's see, Cannon Falls, that's the Bombers, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Cannon Falls Mighty Bombers? Yeah, okay. So this is something that what we have to watch out for, and I support this bill 100% because we do need to know what can we do. My concern is if we make something better for somebody, you're making it worse for somebody else. But I guess a study with the OLA would let us know how that would all work. But this needs to be done. It's desperately needs to be done.
Thank you, Representative Davids. And sir, if you want to go ahead and identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Yeah, my name is Kyle John Merkins from Red Wing, Minnesota. I just moved back to my hometown this past summer. Fortunate enough to start a family where I grew up in Red Wing, Minnesota. I've been running a small business in IT and development consulting and cloud platforms since 2011. And it got to the point where I wanted to either grow or kind of be happy with where I'm at. And I was looking at the health insurance and how the past couple of years I actually lost mine as an independent. I had an individual plan, lost it, then I had a group plan, then they put some stipulations around how many employees I lost it, and it led us to this last year. I looked at the rates for individual, compared them to the premiums with the deductibles, and then looked at what the group plan would be if I were to hire an employee. It actually worked out that I could actually get the same benefit, cost me the same amount of money as hiring an employee when I was in St. Paul here. And then I ended up deciding to bring on an employee. And about 2 days before the deadline, December 15th, I was notified by my agency selling the policy. He said, hey, we submitted your quote with a St. Paul address. Did you move your business to Red Wing? I said, yes, I did, in November this year. He said, oh, we didn't have it on file. Your premiums are actually going to go up for Goodhue County. And I said, really? And how much? And so the average increase per family, we have one employee. Per year, the plan increase is going to be between $3,300 and $3,900 per family just for moving to Goodhue County. And I have only one employee, so I don't have 35. And so I'm at the point where I want to grow my business and develop apps and do things like that with cloud-based platforms, and I'm really struggling to continue having my business based in Redding, Minnesota. So I'd actually consider moving my business back up to St. Paul to have more competitive rates just to actually go through that. And I want to add that my employee is actually remote in Texas. And so I asked the broker, I said, are you sure his rates and his family should go up? And they said, well, your business is in Goodhue County. But he's remote. He's never going to be in Minnesota. So I kind of was forced to make the decision this year because I had 2 days before the deadline and continued with it. But I'm definitely considering moving my business back up to St. Paul to get the benefit because it's totaling for my business right now, it's $8,000 out of pocket difference. And my total premiums for me and my my employer right now, we're paying it's $36,340 a year.
Wow. Thank you. I think it's always good for the community to hear real-world examples. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to these business owners for bringing this up. It's you guys are swept up in this strange business of healthcare policy that did not get written in any healthcare code. It all got written in the tax code 50, 60 years ago. And as healthcare changes and grows and becomes more costly, you know, our small employers are having to become experts in something that they never wanted to be experts on in the first place. And so my apologies to you. It's kind of by a, you know, just a random act of legislating many, many years ago that this is falling on your laps. And I think that we need to fix it. I do think that the question being raised is a really good one, Representative Haley. I would be very interested to encourage you to think about including a study of the root causes for the cost discrepancies in there. There's been some good reports that have come out recently from, I believe, the Department of Health, community measurement projects and others that really are starting to highlight the issue of cost discrepancies across the state of Minnesota among different providers. We have not come up with a policy solution to that, but I think that having better data on that would be very helpful to us as policymakers. When you look at a single procedure can vary $20,000 across county lines or whatever it might be, that's a pretty big concern, and I think we need to get to the root causes of it. We tend to, and this has nothing to do with your bill, this is just the way we deal with healthcare. It's a constant emergency to try to fix these kind of increases, and so we do things at a much more surface level without getting to root causes. And I think this is because you're asking a question to be investigated. I think that it's a real opportunity to dig into root causes and see where we can fix it at the actual root of the problem instead of doing a quick fix at the top, which very often leads to other issues. So just a suggestion. I think it's a really important question we're asking.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure what my friend, Representative Halverson, is talking about, this being a problem of tax code from 50 or 60 years ago. From the way I understand the bill that I haven't read, is that this is a result of the ACA determining rating areas and how those, the Department of Commerce was forced by the ACA to determine these areas. This has nothing to do with the tax code from 50 or 60 years ago. Representative Haley, unless you could correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Chairman, what we're dealing with here is problems from the ACA that force the Commerce Commissioner to have rating areas, and this is what we've ended up with. That's the problem, unless I'm missing something.
Yep. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Davids. That would be my understanding as well. We were required under the ACA to have rating areas that were your MSAs plus one. We have nine. They didn't instruct us on how to draw the lines around those rating areas. That was a decision made by our Commerce Department. So we have a very large rating area, as you know. That's the Metro, St. Cloud, all the way down to Dakota County, and then much smaller rating areas around the rest of the state.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative,
it caught my attention from Representative Halverson because it would be very rare for tax policy to create any problems.
Representative Davids, I'm sure that's what everyone here was thinking. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mentioned me by name. I need to respond.
Representative Halverson.
If I may. Representative Davids and other members of the Commerce Committee, I think it's really important to note that our health care policy when it comes to health care coverage was not written in any kind of health care code. It was absolutely written in federal tax code. And that's why our employers are such a huge part of the health care system, is because it was written as a tax benefit for employers. And so that is why it's much more an accident of where these policies got written. And so it absolutely, and I don't think that that's where we should be writing health policy. I think that we need to create health policy that focuses on making people healthier. And we focus a lot on how we're paying and who's paying, and our employers, especially small employers, are swept up in that. And so that, to me, is the accident of birth, if you will, with regard to the way this all started back at the beginning of the dawn of health insurance. So that is what they are swept up in.
And, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davidson.
Yes, there were things done 60, probably 70, probably more years ago than that in tax policy that guided businesses to be providing benefits, and it goes back to when wages were frozen, so you had to attract the best and the brightest, so you gave benefits instead of increases. This bill has nothing to do with tax policy of 60 years ago. This bill has to do with problems created by the ACA. Let's be clear about that. And I didn't mention any names.
Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Minnesota is a rate and file state on insurance premiums. The Commerce Department has very, very little control over what insurance carriers are going to charge. The three filters that insurance rates go through, and that's why this study is so important, why this is an important bill, is rates cannot be excessive. You cannot gouge. Rates cannot be inadequate. Carriers have to be able to keep the promise they made to their insurers that they'll pay the claims, and rates cannot discriminate. And I would hope that the results of this study that I would hope we pass will become a tool, a flashlight, if you will, to use your metaphor, for the Commerce Department to go forward and discern some light on what the basis is for what they are charging some of these people, and get into some of the actual causes of the real problem, which is the high cost of health care, and the systems that have been removed to put downward pressure on the cost of health care and create competition.
Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? Not seeing anybody coming down. Representative Haley, I think you've had some good comments from Representative Lunan and Halverson and Davids. Mm-hmm. I wish you good luck with your bill, and with that, members will go to a vote. I will renew my motion that House File 3198, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on HHS Reform. Those in favor of the passage of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Haley. Thank you, members, for a good discussion. With that, we're going to go to Representative Peterson, House File 3204. And Representative Peterson, I will move your bill, and you also have an amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like it to be in. So, Representative Peterson, I will also move the A1 amendment. Those in favor of the adoption of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Peterson, to your bill as adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Breast cancer is the number one cancer diagnosed in women each year, representing 30% of all new cancer cases for women. In 2017, over 250,000 new cases of invasive breast cancer were diagnosed in the U.S., and 41,000 women died from breast cancer, second only to lung cancer deaths. Mammograms can help find breast cancer early, even before symptoms appear, when it is most treatable. It is estimated that breast cancer deaths have decreased 35% since 1989 because of mammograms, and that 250,000 breast cancer deaths have been averted since that time. The standard of care historically has been what we call 2D mammograms. This mammogram gives a flat image of the inside of the breast, and since breast tissue is often overlapping in these images, it can make them difficult to read. This is particularly true for women who have dense breast tissue. Since dense tissue and tumors both appear very similar on 2D mammograms, and this is why 2D mammograms miss up to 40 to 50% of the cancers in women with dense breasts. It's estimated that 43% of women have dense breasts. And if you can see by this in your handout, this kind of highlights sort of the differences between a 2D and a 3D mammogram. In 2011, the FDA approved what is simply called a 3D mammogram, which takes images in 1-millimeter slices so doctors reading the mammogram can examine each layer of the tissue. They did so in hopes that the clear images would not only improve tumor detection, but also decrease the number of times a woman gets called back for additional tests when doctors aren't sure what they're seeing on the 2D mammogram. The difference between 2D and 3D mammograms have been described by one doctor as the difference of looking at a closed book and paging through the book one page at a time. Since the picture is worth 1,000 words, I again refer back to that picture that is in your packet. And since that time, the FDA has approved of these 3D mammograms. Numerous studies have been done to analyze the benefits of 3D mammograms. The Journal of the American Medical Association published the results of one of the largest studies in 2014. In that study, 455,000 women received 3D mammograms at 13 different major medical centers across the U.S. The results showed a 41% increase in the early detection of potentially lethal tumors and 15% reduction in callbacks for false positives that were experienced with the 2D mammogram. Other studies have also supported these positive results. A clinical study research also showed that 3D imaging resulted in a 96% accuracy rating in distinguishing malignant breast tumors from benign ones. And several other U.S. and European studies have shown even more dramatic benefit to women having 3D mammograms. As a result of these studies, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services decided to cover the additional cost for a 3D mammogram beginning in January of 2015, 3 years ago. According to the CMS, there was sufficient clinical evidence that the effectiveness of the 3D breast imaging to warrant coverage for all women. And several insurance companies have decided to cover the cost of 3D mammograms. In your packet is an announcement from Cigna that they revised their medical coverage policy for breast cancer screening to cover 3D based on guidance from the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, so NCCN, a nonprofit alliance of leading cancer centers such as Mayo Clinic, Sloan Kettering, the Cleveland Clinic, St. Jude's, Texas Anderson Cancer Center, Stanford, Duke, Mass General, and Yale Cancer Centers. There's a complete list in your file. Cigna said that they are always open to change based on new scientific evidence or guidance from respected non-commercial organizations like the NCCN. I understand other companies are also beginning to cover this test, including Health Partners and Medica. But some insurance companies are dragging their feet to cover this procedure in spite of the evidence, even for women who already have breast cancer or are at a high risk of getting it. As a result, 7 states, New York, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Arkansas, Connecticut, Maryland, and Texas have already passed laws mandating this coverage, and many others are also considering approving that in their states as well. My bill is very limited in its scope. It's more limited than what has been passed in other states and simply mandates that women who already have breast cancer or at high risk for getting it have the choice to have this test paid for by their insurance. Why is this important? Because early detection is the key to most successfully beating breast cancer. And 3D mammograms are detecting over 40% more early stage cancers when it is more treatable. and thus cheaper to treat. I also have a testifier here, Mr. Chair, Lisa Hills, who can give her testimony.
Ms. Hills, welcome to the committee.
Thank
Please
you.
Identify yourself for the tape and start whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lisa Hills, and I am the executive director of the Minnesota Newspaper Association, but I'm not testifying for MNA today. I'm here to tell my personal story. 12 years ago, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I was 45 years old, and I started having mammograms when I was in my early 40s. In 2006, I noticed an indent in my left breast. My doctor immediately scheduled a 2D mammogram, and 3Ds were not available at that point. My tumor wasn't detected on the mammogram, and that's when I was told that I had dense breast tissue. Since there was a visual sign of breast cancer, I was immediately scheduled for an ultrasound, and that's when they discovered the tumor. They also detected it later on an MRI. And the tumor measured 1.8 centimeters, about the size of your little fingernail. I chose to have a mastectomy and reconstruction surgery. And prior to surgery, it's common that they perform a sentinel node biopsy. The procedure removes a few lymph nodes to test for cancer, and two of those nodes tested positive. As a result, a total of 22 lymph nodes were removed, and six tested positive for cancer. And my diagnosis was a stage 3A breast cancer. My surgeon suspected my tumor had been there undetected by a 2D mammogram for several years, allowing my cancer to advance. A stage 3 diagnosis is a whole new reality of doctor visits, surgery, scans, and tests. My treatment was extensive. I had 18 chemo infusions, followed by 6 weeks of daily radiation. And then 12 years later, I still take a hormone blocker for cancer, and I still have some side effects from all my treatment. Even with my history and a written order from my surgeon and oncologist, I was told by my insurance company, Blue Cross Blue Shield, that a 3D mammogram wouldn't be covered. My doctors believe a 3D could have detected my breast cancer at an earlier stage and possibly prevented the extensive treatment. House File 3204 simply requires that women like me who already have breast cancer or who are at higher risk of getting breast cancer have the choice of a 3D mammogram paid for by their insurance. It gives women an increased chance for early detection. And thank you very much for your time and consideration. And I respectfully request that you support House File 3204. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hills. And we're glad that you're better. I don't know if you can technically say recover, but we're glad things are going well. Questions, members? Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Peterson, for bringing this bill forward. My wife had a bad 2D scan in last year while we were covered by Blue Cross. Her doctor did ask that she have a 3D. We called Blue Cross, and they said absolutely not. And we since switched and went to Health Partners, and the results were negative, thankfully. But this is a very, very important bill, and thank you for doing it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. Other questions, members? Representative Peterson, do you have another testifier?
No, I
do. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Peterson, for bringing this forward, and I'm very supportive of it. I will admit that as I looked at it, there was an amendment that I believe actually passed off the House floor last year that was authored by Representative Drazkowski that actually removed the mandate for breast cancer, for coverage for breast cancer. It was one that I found really frustrating at the time. And as I look at this, I feel like there's a contrast in that way to having that go off the House floor and say that we're not going to mandate coverage for breast cancer. But when we do, we have this. And again, I'm very supportive of this. But I don't know if you can help me sort of square that or try to understand that, because I felt at the time really frustrated that mandate would be removed. We want to make sure if somebody's buying health insurance that they have health insurance for everything that may well impact them and their family, which certainly would include this. So I just wonder if you can help me think through that.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Pinto. I guess I'm not really sure what happened last year, but this is where we are now. So this is a good bill, and appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Peterson, Representative Pinto. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Peterson. I did sign on to this bill, and I don't usually sign on to a lot of health care bills. I don't know if you know, but I served on the Breast Cancer Education Association for 15 years after losing a dear friend to breast cancer. I fall into the 43% that has to go probably every other year for additional follow-ups and have to go through the anxiety that comes along with that. One thing I want to point out, the reason I got involved with the Breast Cancer Education Association is I was out with a group of friends one evening. It was girlfriend's night out, and I heard a statistic that 1 in 8 women will get breast cancer. I counted up the number of women sitting at this table, including the testifier chair. There's 13 of us women here. We have one person already diagnosed with breast cancer. Add a couple more women, and that means somebody else probably sitting at this table will be diagnosed with breast cancer. So thank you again for bringing forward that bill. It's a really important bill.
Thank you, Representative Barr. Is there anybody in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? Mr. Graves, welcome back to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm the Director of Healthcare and Transportation Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I've had the chance to talk to the bill author about this issue and also to some of the folks who are supportive of this, and appreciate them taking the time to talk to me and kind of educate me about the background here and have done a great job of certainly making a case. Nevertheless, you know, we at the Chamber, you know, wouldn't be remiss if we didn't express some concern about adding to the already very long list of things that are required to be covered in Minnesota for fully insured plans. Minnesota requires coverage for more than 60 benefits already. We, you know, by some estimates, are at the very top of the list, within the top five of the list when considering the number of mandated benefits, and all that comes at a cost to premium payers. And those costs fall disproportionately on small employers who are in the fully insured market who must comply with all these requirements. So, again, I think the author has done a very good job of articulating the reasons why she's brought this forward and certainly makes a very compelling case. But nonetheless, it is a concern of ours when we have discussions about adding to the already very long list of things that are required to be covered. But would certainly look forward to continuing these discussions with the author and others as the bill moves forward through the process and appreciate the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. Representative Davids.
Thank you. And not so much for the witness or the author, but there's brought up the Drazkowski bill from last year. I think it was a bit mischaracterized because if I remember correctly, on that bill, you could pick and choose any mandate you wanted to. You would not have to have anything removed if you didn't want to. So I think we need to be a little careful on that one because you could get breast cancer coverage or whatever. I remember they're talking about why is a male age 64 paying for pregnancy coverage? And so there were some choices that could be made on that. It wasn't that bill would just eliminate every coverage. So I don't want to leave anyone with that impression.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and to Chair Davids, I certainly didn't intend to leave that impression. I think what I said is that it would remove the mandate for coverage of breast cancer. But similarly, this is saying that where there is breast cancer, there will be a mandate to have a digital breast tomosynthesis. And it seems like that's an appropriate thing to do, as it seems to me it's appropriate as well to have that. It feels like a contrast, but I understand there may be a disagreement on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Ms. Commit, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Commit, and I'm from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. And like Bentley Graves, I will also say that I've had an opportunity to work with Representative Roz Peterson on this legislation. We appreciate very much her willingness to look at various issues with this legislation. Clearly, this is an important issue. A couple of things, and I really appreciate Representative Peterson's willingness to sort of scope the bill and make sure that it's directed at those people who would most benefit from having this type of mammogram. There's still a little bit of uncertainty out there. The United States Preventive Services Task Force, which is a national U.S. clearinghouse that reviews technology and treatments, finds that 3D mammography is a promising new technology for detecting breast cancer, but it's not clear whether this technology will result in improved health, quality of life, or fewer deaths among the women screened. Clearly, and I hear from the testifiers, it makes a big difference for individuals. Again, this is just looking at the more global perspective from a public policy perspective. As a result, the task force could not make a recommendation for or against the use of 3D mammography, but strongly encourages additional research in this area. And then just one other note I would mention to the committee, and that is this bill, it depends on how the final language is, but typically what was required in the Affordable Care Act was that an incentive for states not to pass additional mandated benefits, because if they did, that would just increase the cost to the ACA, make the premiums go up, and they would end up paying more in APTC credits and that sort of thing. So they put language in the ACA that said the state of Minnesota or any state would be required to defray the additional costs for qualified health plans associated with any type of mandate like this one, because the mandate is not included as part of the existing health benefit set. So there would likely be a fiscal note. We don't know what that would be. We don't know exactly how much that is. I know there's some controversy as to whether or not this actually is a mandate. I think we need to do some more work on that and understand that better. And we're talking with Representative Peterson to work on that.
We always appreciate that. Thank you, Ms. Kmit. And hang on, Representative Lewin, hang on. We're going to have Mr. Hickey come down, but while he's on his way down, we normally don't get visits from the State Patrol here in the Commerce Committee, so I'd just like to point out that we have some visitors up in the corner. Gentlemen, you're always welcome. Thank you for coming to the Capitol today. Thank you for visiting our committee. And Representative Lunan, do you have a question right now, or do you want?
I do have a question.
Representative Lunan.
And it had to do with the previous testifier's comment also regarding a fiscal note. I was wondering what the cost difference is between the two different procedures, and to see if there's some middle ground solution on covering the same amount on both, and then the rest would be out of pocket for the insurer.
So Representative Peterson, do you have an answer to that, or Ms. Kmit, do you have an answer, or is this something you're going to find out for HHS reform?
Mr. Chair, the extra cost of the 3D does vary. I've heard it's usually between $50 to $125, but a friend of mine just paid $300. Representative Halverson said she just paid $115 for hers. So it's a sliding scale. So
thank
anywhere
you.
From $50 to $300, I suppose, would be a good range.
Good question, good answer. Thank you. With that, Mr. Hickey, welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business, who represent about 11,000 small business owners who have really struggled with this health insurance issue since the passage of Obamacare. Actually, we struggled with it before because Minnesota had so many mandates, and we were happy and proud to be part of the effort to roll those back, provide a choice to people, pass the flexible benefit plan legislation that the late Senator Linda Scheib worked so hard on, recognizing that people need choices and people need to be held responsible for choices. But we've lost all that, Mr. Chairman. Obamacare has usurped virtually every insurance law across the insurance law across the 50 states, and we find ourselves now in a situation where, as you know, as serious and dire the situation could be, we are looking at possibly a new mandate, certainly an expansion. And the message I can give you from my members who have struggled so hard with this since 2014 is we do not need to even increase health insurance costs by 1% due to actions of this state legislature. Our members are beleaguered. They're rate shocked. And all of you know that. You worked hard last year to try to help. We really appreciate that. You passed two major bills to try to help people who are being priced out of the market. But there is going to be a cost to this mandate. It's my understanding that 3D mammograms are typically diagnostic and not preventive. And so due to that and the fact that the legislation clearly says on line 110 and 111 that no additional cost can be passed on to the enrollee, there is going to be an additional cost to this. And I think before we get too far ahead with this bill, we need to find out exactly what that is, Mr. Chairman. Also, there's just another huge issue here that really sticks in our craw, and that is this tremendous ERISA inequity. You can't do anything in this committee to regulate ERISA plans. That's about 60 to 70% of the private market right now. An increasing number of government groups, including our own state of Minnesota, Hennepin County, U of M, and I should do the survey for you because there would be a long list. And they have all bailed out of this market, and you can't do anything to regulate them. And so here we are trying to do yet another new mandate, as you know, dire and serious as these situations can be, on this dwindling group of people who have been shell-shocked, price-weary, and priced out of the market time and time again. And once again, appreciate the, you know, the huge things you did last year to try to help them. And so we're just very concerned about what we're doing here, and I hope before this goes much further, we find out exactly how much additional cost it will be. Finally, I just want to raise the point that as Commit raised, this possibly could trigger the requirement under Obamacare that if states are going to add new mandates onto an already stuffed, packed, expensive essential benefit set, that they have to pay for it. And I think we need to look hard into that too, and the state could have, you know, some modest fiscal liability. But I know it's a dire, serious issue, but so is people being priced out of the insurance market. And our members are very upset about it, and pretty much feel a desperation on it due to the fact Washington can't address this issue. And you've done a lot here. So thanks for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Peterson, before 3D was available and you got a positive on a 2D, what was the procedure that you would follow?
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if I'm qualified to answer that question.
I believe it would be a biopsy or something along those lines, and that is much more expensive than doing the 3D.
Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. Members, any other questions? I asked earlier, kind of jumped the line a little bit, is there anybody else that wants to speak for or against this bill? Not seeing anybody moving. With that, Representative Peterson, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you to the many bipartisan co-authors on this bill. I am sensitive to rising health care costs as well, but I believe that this approach is actually smarter health care coverage. That way, maybe there is an upfront cost for the initial test, but overall it will lower costs because you will be able to treat the actual disease quicker, and also you won't have to do multiple tests, because right now you do a 2D test and then you do a 3D test. And this is for a very specific population who are already at risk. So it's not for everyone, and but everyone does already have a mammogram mandated. That is already part of our health insurance mandate. So I think that by being a little bit smarter about these requirements, we'll not only have the right outcomes that we want, but overall reduce costs as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3204, as amended, be referred to the Committee on HHS Reform. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Congratulations, Representative Peterson. You're on your way.
Thank you.
With that, Representative Davids, we will quickly do House File 3543, and then after that, we will go on to the ECO ATM bill. Representative Davids will move House File 3543 so that it is properly in front of the committee. With that, Representative Davids, do your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. What House File 3543 hopes to accomplish is lowering the cost of insurance to Minnesotans that are in the individual market. Some years ago, I sat right over where I sit, and when the Atkins bill was coming through to have MinSure establish in Minnesota, they said that they're going to charge 1.5% of a premium tax. And I said, well, I think the bill said 3.5, you could go up to 3.5. My argument was that if you were going to charge 1.5, let's go with 1.5. Well, we were assured that it certainly wouldn't go up above 2. Well, how'd that work for us? We're at 3.5 on a premium that is over double what it was at that time. So what I'm looking at here is we go from, very simply, the bill goes from 3.5% to 2%. That would save Minnesota consumers in the individual market $30 million a year. And remember that 2% is on double over double what the price was when Minsure first went into effect. We eliminate active purchaser, which now lets unelected bureaucrats in St. Paul limit health care choices for Minnesotans everywhere. We will expand options for Minnesotans by letting them receive premium tax credits when purchasing qualifying plans wherever is most convenient for them. It doesn't have to be on exchange. It would just be as you're purchasing your health insurance, you would qualify for the credits. And, of course, today the courts ruled that in Minnesota here we could use the federal exchange and receive the credits. So we have this extra layer, very expensive extra layer, interfering with the credits. We don't need Minsure for the credits once the court determined that you could use the federal exchange and still receive the credits. We will ensure that this bill also will ensure that government agencies do not put taxpayers at massive financial risk, and there'd be no backfilling because the premium tax will go from 3.5 to 2. They could not look elsewhere to other agencies to be subsidized by them. In the last couple of years, about 3 years ago, I think rates on average went up 40%. 2 years ago, they went up 67%. That's 107%. The legislature had a 25% subsidy that knocked it down 25%. We said, oh, aren't we great? Well, then last year, we passed a bill for a reinsurance bill that leveled rates, but the subsidy went away. So even if you had a level rate, you had a 25% increase. We have to get our arms around this situation here, and I think this bill would help us on the way. I appreciate your support. Stand for any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davids. And we have an amendment. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the DE2 amendment.
Representative Halverson moves the DE2 amendment. Representative Halverson, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that everybody wants to solve the issue of access and affordability in our healthcare system. That is a major issue. And we need to get to, as I said earlier, root causes. The underlying cost of care is a huge issue. This is the reason that we see premium increases going up. One of the things that is true is that the amount of healthcare cost in the individual market is not covered by the premiums that are collected. In fact, they never have been. We've always subsidized the individual market. And so the fact that we're seeing high costs in the individual market is not necessarily a surprise, but the way that we deal with it needs to address the issue of accessibility and affordability for people. And I think that we need to talk about how we pay for it, but we also need to talk about what we're paying for and making sure that we're getting better cost savings out of our system. So I think that there's one of two ways that we can go about thinking about how we cover Minnesotans, and we could cover more of them or we could cover less of them. Minnesota has always had a value, a bipartisan value, since the creation of Minnesota Care, that we were going to cover more Minnesotans. And by doing so, we actually had better cost controls and we had better cost, better insurance coverage in the state of Minnesota than just about anywhere else. So this amendment would take a different approach and cover more Minnesotans as opposed to less by offering the Minnesota Care buy-in option and request a federal waiver.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would request a roll call.
Roll call having been requested. Are there members any other comments or questions on the amendment? Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the concerns I have with this amendment or this mechanics is currently what's going on in healthcare right now is cost shifting. It's a shell game going on. So if I'm on medical assistance or MA at all, what the medical provider gets reimbursed is at a very, very low rate. If it's Medicaid, it's oftentimes a rate below their expenses. The wink-wink deal the government does with the provider is that if you will accept those lower payments and see those patients, we are going to allow you to shift that cost over to other people you are seeing. That's why when you go to the emergency room, that nurse asks you, were you at work when you got hurt? They're looking for work comp. Were you in a car when you got hurt? They're looking for auto no fault. Why? Because there's no fee schedules there, which allows them to shift the costs over. I agree with Representative Halverson. The cost of health care is the root of the weed, is the root of the problem. But putting in a mechanism that's just going to facilitate or cause more cost shifting is not going to be a solution. It's just cutting a leaf off the weed. I think we go for the home run and actually address the root problem, which is the actual cost, not the cost to the patient, the cost charged.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you. If you vote for this amendment, you'd be increasing cost to Minnesota health insurance purchasers by $30 million. So if you want to increase their premiums $30 million, I suggest you vote for this. And I also see the repeal of the Minnesota Care Provider Tax sunset. Does that put the provider tax back in force?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, yes, we would repeal the Minnesota Care Provider Tax sunset, and I think that we would have really good options with which to use those dollars. Mr. Hickey earlier talked about ERISA plans and how little control Minnesota has over ERISA plans, and we do. We actually ask small businesses and individuals to bear the brunt of cost in our Minnesota healthcare system. The one mechanism we have had since 1992 is to have the ERISA plans participate in Minnesota's healthcare system is through the provider tax, and that has been used expressly to expand care to Minnesotans and to expand affordable health care to Minnesotans. And I think that Representative Lunan brings up a fantastic point about the cost shifting in the system. We're not paying for what care costs. We're paying for underpayment, uncompensated care, all kinds of other things in the system. And we need to start paying for what care costs. And one of the ways that we could do that, we could actually even think about using that income from the provider tax, which is a pass-through tax that providers collect on ERISA plan payers and is paid for through those ERISA plans. And so it's a way for us to get revenue in the system that does not unnecessarily burden small businesses and individuals. And we could use that to expand reimbursement rates as well, because one of the things that we need to do, one of the ways Minnesota Care is really winning in greater Minnesota is it has much more substantial networks than a lot of other plans that people are looking to. Minnesota Care has been a gold standard for health care around the country. In fact, a lot of other states have looked to us and said, how did you get that done? How did you close that gap in your uninsured market? And we did it very simply, members, by creating a bipartisan plan and having a way to pay for it. We have to be able to make sure that we are not creating an unstable system where our members of the individual and small group markets are going to be floating out in the ether. We have to make sure that there is a safety net in place.
Representative Davis.
I would just ask members to vote no on the amendment, the DE2 amendment, please.
Thank you, Representative Davids. With that roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Hoppe.
No.
Allen. Anderson.
No.
Applebaum.
No.
Barr.
No.
Davids.
No.
Franzen.
No.
Halverson.
Yes.
Hillstrom.
Yes.
Johnson. Kreisha. Loon.
No.
Lunan.
Nope.
Nash.
Nope.
O'Driscoll.
No.
Pinto.
Yes.
Rosenthal.
Aye.
Slocum. Smith.
No.
Swizinski.
Nope.
Representative Fenton.
No.
The roll call reflects a tally of 14-4. The amendment does not adopt it.
Mr. Chairman, for the sake of brevity, I think that there's somebody wanted to testify, but
if there's somebody that does want to come down and speak for or against the bill, come on down. Otherwise,
I think I've described the bill brilliantly, and everybody should understand what it does.
Any other questions for members? Not seeing anybody looking like they want to come down. Representative Kreisha.
I'd like to request
request for roll call, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Roll call having been requested. Seeing nothing else, Representative Davids will renew his motion in House File 3543 be re-referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. With having said that, roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Hoppe.
Aye.
Fenton.
Aye.
Allen. Anderson.
Aye.
Applebaum.
No.
Barr.
Aye.
Davids.
Aye.
Franson.
Yes.
Halverson.
No.
Hillstrom.
No.
Johnson. Kreisha.
Aye.
Loon.
Aye.
Loonen.
Aye.
Nash.
Aye.
O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Pinto.
No.
Rosenthal.
No.
Slocum. Smith.
Aye.
Swizinski.
Aye.
Mm-hmm. By a vote of 13-5, the bill passes. Congratulations, Representative Davids. It's on its way to HHS Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you, Representative Davids. And we're going to jump up our schedule a little bit here and go to Representative Fenton on the ECO ATM bill. Representative Fenton will move House File 3225. I have it here somewhere. Representative Fenton, go ahead and start testifying whenever you'd like, or have your testifier testify, whatever works for you.
Thank you. Thank you, members. House File 3225 is to allow the ECO ATM to re-enter the marketplace here in Minnesota. So what this is an automated kiosk that purchases used cell phones for cash provided certain requirements are met. Beginning next month, this currently will be in 47 states. So why is one reason this is very important is because of what the ECO ATM does. So this is a recycling program held to high standards to responsibly recycle old cell phones. So currently across the country right now, there are about 400 million cell phones sitting around in drawers across America. And I know I have some with the number of phones my kids would go through. And so ECO ATM, and I just want to tell you, four phones will equal 1 pound of electronic waste. And I can pass this around as you could see what all types of parts go into these cell phones if you want. So the ECO ATM partners with retailers. They would be partnering with retailers here in Minnesota, providing a safe place and no stranger danger for people who want to turn in their phone for money. And these are high-tech machines with security features. And also in conversations with stakeholders and whatnot, in conversations with the Sheriff's Association, the Minnesota Chiefs of Police, and MPPOA, currently they have no opposition. But I do want to turn it over to my expert testifier, Ms. Bonnie Garcia.
Ms. Garcia, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, thank you first to the author, Representative Fenton and Representative Pinto. You may be more familiar with our sister companies, Redbox and Coinstar. We have combined more kiosks than there are McDonald's and Starbucks across the United States. And we previously were in the state of Minnesota in cities such as Rochester, Roseville, St. Cloud, and St. Paul. And we left the state a little bit before 2015 when there was a change in law addressing kill switches and cell phones. Unfortunately, it put us out of business because we pay our consumers in cash for their recyclable phones. How we are different than pawn shops and secondhand dealers, first and foremost, we do not resell to consumers. We buy broken and used cell phones and tablets directly from consumers. We rent space inside a major retail store like a Walmart, a Kroger, or Costco, and the consumer can only use the machine during normal operating hours. When they interact with the machine, it looks like a big green machine, about the same size as the red box machine. When they interact with the machine, they first tell it what kind of phone they have. Most people don't even know what kind of phone they have, you know, in terms of capacity, but they do know that it's a phone that they're paying AT&T for, and it's an iPhone or a, you know, a BlackBerry or something like that. When they stick the phone inside the machine, it will interrogate the phone and will look at the electronic components, take about 2,000 very quick pictures to make sure it's not a clone or a fake phone, and it will run it against two databases, one maintained by Leeds Online and the other maintained by Checkmen, which is where you report your lost device to your carrier. If the serial number, or in this case now manufacturers use an IMEI or an international identifier number, is found to be blocked, for some reason the device has been reported lost or stolen, or there's another problem with the serial number, we will immediately stop the transaction and not move forward. We operate in 46 states currently. We'll be moving into our 47th state, Connecticut, later this year, and so far we have bought 14 million phones. That's the equivalent of 3.5 million pounds of electronic waste that we've paid consumers over $100 million. The most important to us as a green company is that we are allowing consumers to responsibly recycle instead of throwing those phones into a drawer where a cracked phone will start to leach. I think you may have some materials, lead, bromine, mercury, chlorine, and even arsenic. And it's also a phone that's not going to end up in your local landfill costing government any dollars. So we operate as a private enterprise. We operate with no help from the federal government or state government. We're proud to say that we are partners across 2,400 different jurisdictions in the United States, and we have responsibly helped communities recycle phones. So I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Garcia. Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you. I'm happy to ask all the questions after all the testifiers. Is there anyone else that wants to go?
Is there anybody that wants to speak for or against the bill? And members, we're planning to send this bill to the General Register, but Representative Hillstrom is the lead on the Civil Law Committee, and I think we're going to be a little bit more civil law-ish today than we would normally be, just in an effort to try to help the process along and get the best bill that we can. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's my understanding that they have an amendment in the Senate that I haven't seen yet that they're working on. And so that may go a long way to take care of any of the questions that I might have. But I do have a particular interest in, actually I have nonpartisan research upstairs checking on one provision. I noticed that in the pawnbroker statute, when they turn in a phone that comes up stolen, that we require pawnbrokers to contact the person who owned the property and contact the police department. And currently in this process, they don't keep the phone, they return it to the person who brought it. And so I do have some concern that we may have to continue to talk about between now and the end. It's just we treat a pawnbroker differently than we would be treating this particular kiosk. And so that really is one of my concerns with this particular bill.
Ms. Gutierrez?
Yeah, if I may answer. We've bought 14 million phones across the United States, and there are several steps in the process. The first screen that the consumer sees tells him that we will report every sale, each and every sale, to law enforcement. So if they move forward with the transaction, they also electronically sign that they are the owner of that device, and they attest to as such. So if we end up with a stolen phone, we, the company, becomes the victim, not the person who lost that phone. Our policy and our procedures across the United States, regardless of what your local law is, we make the consumer whole. So unlike pawn shops, for example, that may have bought an item that was stolen, we don't recover from the victim. We return the device to the victim through the law enforcement agency if there was an actual lost device reported. And because of our strict, we have about 16 layers of security, because of our strict protocols, less than 0.5% of 14 million devices are returned at all. Now, at the point of sale, if a consumer presents a stolen device, we won't know if the device is stolen, we won't know if it's lost, we won't know what reason the database has discovered that that serial number is blocked, but we will stop the transaction there. So we've, for privacy reasons and for other reasons, if we don't move forward with the sale, we don't know who that consumer is. We just know that there's a problem with that serial number and the transaction is canceled.
Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, and then the phone is returned to whoever brought it. Is that correct?
Whoever, for whatever reason that that number was blocked, you know, I hate to tell you some of the reasons, but sometimes we may have an older child sell his parents' phone. We may have a spouse that discovered a mistress on the pictures, you know, on the phone and sold the phone. We may decide that somebody who reported it lost to their carrier now wants to, you know, resell the device. So for whatever reason, we don't know why that serial number is blocked. We can't assume that it's stolen, and it would be an illegal seizure if we took it into our possession.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just we require that a pawn shop take it, and not only take it. Well, I shouldn't say we, because I'm looking at the Minneapolis police website about what they require, because I have people upstairs looking at the statute. She does the regulation of pawn shops. However, the criminal portion is with somebody else, and so I had that somebody else come down and go back upstairs to take a look. And so we require that if somebody brings in a stolen item to a pawn shop, that the pawn shop actually keeps it and then calls the person who reported it stolen and the police department, at least according to the website. And so I'm happy to continue to talk to you, and I know they're amending it in the Senate. And so I just want you to know that that is one of the concerns that we have, right? Ultimately, no one wants to buy a stolen phone, right, because you don't want to own it. And we don't want the person who stole it to get it back if we get it in our possession at some point. So that's kind of the concern. And so I'm happy to continue to talk about it, given that they're amending it in the Senate anyways.
Representative Hillstrom, thank you. We appreciate that. And in lieu of having the bill be referred to civil law, I appreciate your willingness to work with the author, as I'm sure she appreciates the willingness to look at the Senate amendment, whatever that might be, and make this thing right. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And either to Representative Fenton or to your testifier, I'm just curious and how this operates from the consumer standpoint. Do you have to have your phone wiped clean before you sell? Is there any danger if there's, I don't know, names and phone numbers or addresses or personal information on your phone that would somehow be captured? And then also, I'm just wondering if you could enlighten me a little bit on the business model. I mean, are the components torn apart and it's enough by recycling those and repurposing them that this obviously can make sense from a business standpoint?
Thank you for the question. So let me answer the first. When you look for an Eco ATM machine, you might find it in the store, or you might look for it online. Most people will look for a location online, and there's some criteria that it will walk you through so that you can wipe off your phone. If you don't know how to do that, or you just don't want to do that, when you sell your phone to Eco ATM, we are an R2 certified recycler. There are about 425 in the world. We meet very strict auditing and EPA standards, and three different certificates that we have. One is for data privacy, and the other one is for the other two are for recycling, how we go through that method. R2 recycling means that as a recycler, we're responsible for that waste stream from the day that we acquire it to the end. All of our recycling is done within the United States. Greater than 70% of the phones that are turned in are phones that are broken, fell in the toilet, don't charge up anymore, etc. When you sell a phone to Eco ATM, there's a little sticker that comes out of the machine, is attached to the phone, and as it's going through the processing system, we're tracking that phone from the point of sale to the end of life. The device, however you sold it, remains intact for 30 days. If it's wedding pictures, if it's your cat or dog pictures, whatever you left on it, nobody will see those. At the end of 30 days, the phone is automatically cleared, period. So even if you thought you did a reset, we will do a secondary reset, but nobody is manually going through the phones.
Thank you, Ms. Garcia.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
regarding the recycling of the components, the recycling is done all within the United States. Our main processing facility is in Louisville, Kentucky. The components of the phone, both ourselves and the subcontractors that are working with us alongside this, were held to high standards in terms of environment where the employees work and also how we handle the carcinogens that are within the device. Everything is parted out responsibly, and if the phone has a second life, most cell phones, when people throw them out, still have at least 70% of life left. So if it's a phone that can be reused that's a little bit more modern, let's say an iPhone 4 or 5, that phone operates here as a smartphone but may be used overseas strictly as a phone. It does not have smart capabilities overseas. So it will be refurbished in-house and then resold to a wholesaler. We do not sell to the general public.
Thank you, Ms. Garcia. Any other questions, members? Seeing none, with that, Representative Fenton will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I think this is a good option for consumer choice and who want to be responsible about protecting our environment and doing recycling their phones the right way. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. And with that, Representative Fenton renews her motion that House File 3225 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Ms. Garcia. Thank you, Representative Fenton, and members for a good discussion, especially Representative Hillstrom. With that, we are on to Representative O'Driscoll, House File 2829.
5 minutes.
Representative O'Driscoll, go ahead. You can move House File 2829.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2829 be re-referred to the General Register, and I do have a DE3 amendment to get the bill in the form that I would like.
Thank you. I was just going to ask that I'm having staple problems here. All those in favor of the adoption of the DE3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative O'Driscoll, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have with me Byron Miller from the Appraisal Association, and he would like to make a few comments after I do a quick setup on the bill. The past few years, I've had the opportunity to carry the appraisers' corrections and technical bill, and this year the appraisers' association would like to set up an appraiser advisory board within the Department of Commerce. The purpose of this would be to bring in industry professionals who would have the opportunity to be able to work with others in the industry. And I'd like to actually draw members' attention to the DE amendment, page 3, lines 3.8 through 3.1. This defines what the role of the committee would be, or the advisory task force. It says, in part, the board shall advise, provide input, and make recommendations to the department regarding licensing, continuing education, disciplinary action, and industry-related trends. And industry-related trends would be how they perhaps would interact with other professionals in the industry, the building industry, the real estate sales industry, the mortgage industry, and the like. And they have been working for about 2 years on and off with the Department of Commerce. And by my time, without having to pay too much royalty to Chair Davids, they do believe they have peace in the valley on this. And so, Mr. Chair, those are my comments this morning, or this afternoon.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Mr. Miller, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Hoppe. Thank you, committee members. I want to thank you for hearing this bill. We are asking that you support HF 2829. Which is the reconstituted appraisal advisory board. The original board was created in the late 1990s, and it was sunset in 2014 after achieving its scope of work to providing advice regarding appraisal licensing CE. This board is to provide advice regarding licensing CE and industry best practices, to name a few, as Representative O'Driscoll just mentioned. We have a good working relationship with the Department of Commerce. And the board is a formal mechanism to continue this communication feedback loop with appraisal industry and the Department of Commerce after our current players move on.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's to the author on page 3, line 3.3, they just talk about they would oversee continuing ed. This bill in no way increases any continuing ed, from the way I read this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Representative Davis, this bill does not speak to the specific requirements of continuing education.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, because whether it be insurance or I find that continuing education classes are the biggest waste of time in history, other than one I went to by Representative Lunan, which was actually quite interesting.
It was an interesting day.
9/11, 2001.
Thank you, Representative Davids. And I think everybody on the committee, like myself, is stunned to find out that you don't like continuing education. That's a new thing for us. Mr. Rickwitty. Mr. Brickwitty, welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner from the Commerce Department. I'll keep it very brief. I would echo most of, in fact, all of Mr. Miller's comments. We have worked with the North Star chapter of the Appraiser Institute to craft the language of the DE amendment. Thank you to Representative O'Driscoll for bringing it forward. And Mr. Miller's comments on the feedback loop that we're trying to set up are exactly right. There was a previously existing appraiser advisory board that was eliminated from statute in the un-session. Bringing it back will create, as Mr. Miller said, a permanent venue for the continued good dialogue that we have had with the industry and hopefully will lead to a better regulated industry. I will note for members there's a very small fiscal cost to the agency as members would be potentially compensated. The department is agnostic to that. I think there are good arguments for members being compensated. We would simply ask that that not come out of existing department resources if the legislature were to enact this in the law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. Not seeing any questions. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? Not seeing anybody. Representative O'Driscoll will give you the final word.
Thank you, members. I appreciate your support.
Representative O'Driscoll, and members, I apologize. When I announced Representative O'Driscoll's initial motion, I did not say that where we were re-referring it. It is going to the Committee on Government Operations. So No, it was my fault.
I'm the chair of that committee, and I knew it had to come to my committee. That's probably a little embarrassing.
With that, Representative O'Driscoll renews his motion that House File 2829, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Congratulations, Representative O'Driscoll, on adding to your own workload. And you can stay right there, and we will go right into House File 3418.
Thank you,
Mr. Miller.
Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 3418 before the committee and for the General Register. I knew one of them was going to the General Register today, so.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Moves House File 3418 with that to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill provides clarity between state-to-state services and in a manner of consistency with some certain motor vehicle services contracts that can be available, having to do with tire replacement, wheel damage, windshield damage due to road hazard, and dings and the like with indoors vehicles. And the like. And so with this, at this point, I would like to turn over to Mr. Cassidy, and he can maybe give a little bit further detail and answer some member questions if there are any.
Mr. Cassidy, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Paul Cassidy with the law firm of Stinson Leonard Street. Our client is the Motor Vehicle Protection Products Association, which is an association of distributors and providers that distribute motor vehicle protection products. When you buy a new or used car, you may obviously get a list of things that you can add onto that that transaction, including paint protection, paint film protection, dent replacement, GPS, glass etching, tire protection, even key fob protection. This legislation before you just updates the chapter that we put into law in 2005 regulating service contracts. It does nothing to change the Department of Commerce's authority to register these companies or the financial assurances required in the chapter or any of the other consumer protections baked into Chapter 59B. With that, members, I will stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cassidy. Members, any questions? Anybody else in the audience that wants to come down and speak on this bill? Not seeing anybody. With that, Representative O'Driscoll will give you the final word, should you want one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just renew my motion that House File 3418 be referred to the General Register, please.
All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Mr. Cassidy and Representative O'Driscoll. That bill is on its way to the General Register. Last bill of the day, Representative Swidzinski, if you want to go ahead and move House File 2363.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, I move House File 2363 to refer to the General Register.
And Representative Swidzinski, do you also have the A18-0583 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that amendment before the committee to get it in the shape we'd like before we begin discussion.
All those in favor of adopting the A18-0583 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And there's also an oral amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We had inadvertently put the beginning date of 2017. We need that to be orally changed to 2018.
And that's on line 16.13?
Yes.
All right. Hang on 1 second. Make sure we got that. So that would be the last line of the actual bill.
Mr. Chair, 16.13.
Okay. Members, does everybody see the oral amendment on page 16 of the bill? Technical, just changing the date from 27 to 2018.
Do we need to vote on it, or can we just adopt it?
Let's vote on it just to be on the safe side. Those in favor of the adoption of the change of the year from 2017 to 2018, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The oral amendment is adopted. Thank you, members. And with that, Representative Swidzinski, to your bill.
Yes, thank Chair Pahapi. Thanks, members of the Commerce Committee. 2363 is a bill that updates statute to conform the Revised Uniform Athletes Agent Act, the RUAA. This bill makes numerous changes to the original act, including expansion the definitions of athlete agent and student athlete. It allows reciprocal registration between states and adds new notification and signing requirements to agency contracts. I got Mr. Dennison here to explain a bit more about some of the other parts of the bill, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Dennison, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Robert Dennison. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis. I'm also retired, but I'm a uniform law commissioner. I'm here in my duties as a commissioner. This change in the law is not as big as it might look from the bill. Minnesota adopted the Uniform Athlete Agents Act in 2002. It governs the relationship between athlete agents and athletes and college athletes and colleges. Over the years, the act's been adopted in 43 states, and we found that the definition of an athlete agent has been too narrow. So some states have been expanding the definition to include additional people who act indirectly on behalf of someone. And we've also seen the situation recently where there's been a major scandal with regard to some of the shoe companies and others have been financing athletes improperly. What this act does is expands the definition of an athlete agent to cover those situations. It also expands the information that an agent must disclose to register, and it also makes it easier for agents in some ways because it provides for reciprocity from one state to another if the state's laws are comparable. So it makes it easier in that sense. Amendments, the changes really are well down to what the author already said. So we could go through it piece by piece and compare it to the old act, but that might take a lot of time. And I know it's getting close to cocktail hour or dinner hour, sorry. But I'd be happy to go through it in more detail.
You had us at cocktail hour, Mr. Tennyson. Members, any questions for the author or the testifier? I know Mr. Brickwitty wants to come down. Come on now, Mr. Brickwitty. Anybody else want to speak for or against the bill? That Mr. Brickwitty, welcome back.
Mr. Chairman, again, Peter Brickwitty from the department. No qualms with the bill. The department registers or licenses athletic agents in the state. We currently have 11. We do not anticipate the changes in this bill dramatically increasing that number one direction or the other.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. I did check my phone, Mr. Tennyson, while you were speaking. No calls for me, so I don't have to worry about this. Thought that'd be funnier. With that, Representative Swedzinski, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. You know, this bill really is kind of a national effort to really clean up the process. There's been a few articles written through Sports Illustrated and others on some damages that previous rules have placed upon students and agents and caused maybe a little misgiving. So with that, I ask for a yes.
Thank you, Representative Swedzinski and Mr. Tennyson. And Mr. Brickwoody, with that, Representative Swedzinski renews his motion that House File 2363, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
You're underway. Thank you, Mr. Tennyson and Representative Swedzinski. Members, thank you. With that, we are adjourned.